Going Linux, episode 207, Listener Feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Bill.
Whether you are new to Linux, upgrading from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux.
We hope that you find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
Today's episode is Listener Feedback. And we'll get into that in a second. But first, Bill, I understand your distro hopping ways are still continuing. So what are you using these days?
Well, I was reading through our emails for this show, and I've been getting beat up by these Fedora people. No, not really. Everybody's been telling me to Fedora's not that bad or whatever, and it's been I haven't used Fedora since Fedora 8, which I believe was called Werewolf. And so I thought I'd give it a whirl, and so that's what I did. Last night I stayed up to 4 a.m. installing everything, wiping off a perfectly good system to reinstall Fedora with all the goodies, and I like the new Cinnamon desktop. That's awesome.
Oh, that's good. That's good. So last Fedora you used was 8. What are we on now?
18.
18. So it's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while because I guess I had drunk too much of the Ubuntu Kool-Aid and just never looked at anything else. And so I figured, just to be fair, I should actually run Fedora on my machine instead of actually install instead of a live CD. So that's what I did, and I have to say, I kind of like it. Everything installed without a hitch, which is, last time I tried to install Fedora, I think it was like 13 or something, I had nothing but problems, but this one was just beautiful. And the great part about this is they have that new Cinnamon desktop, and so I actually have a desktop I like on Fedora. I might not be leaving anytime soon, so
I'll leave that when it comes.
But I have to say, Fedora is just extra yummy, and Jay will understand that reference, and so are our listeners when we read the email. But yeah, Fedora is extra yummy with that little pinch of spice of cinnamon.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. Clever, huh? Okay.
Not bad. Not bad.
So what you been up to? What you been up to?
Well, by the time our listeners hear this, I will be back from my vacation. So I'm hoping I will have had a wonderful vacation. Of course, we're recording this ahead of time. And for those outside the U.S., I'm going on holiday. I guess there are some places in the world besides the U.S. that call it vacation, but yeah.
Did you book my suite?
Yeah, yeah. And did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy it since we're time shifting here?
It was in the engine room. It's kind of noisy.
Yeah, it's the only one that was available at last minute. So, anyway, we'll see how that all plays out. But good news is we're getting this recorded early so that while I'm away for a couple of weeks, this will come out on time. And in our new iteration here of the Going Linux podcast, you're taking on quite a bit more of the editing and producing role, at least learning how to do that. So we'll see how that works out. So far, so good. You're doing a great job, Bill.
Oh, thanks. But don't thank me yet. I haven't got. You won't let me touch the main machines yet.
You got to learn with the training wheels first.
Oh well, yeah. So you won't let me play with the Going Linux mainframe. So you know, I'll have to use my laptop. You know, every time I say, "Well, let me just install something on it," you just slap my hands and kick me out the door. So,
be careful with those old terms like mainframe. The mainframe here is a Raspberry Pi sitting there. Not really, but
Okay, you
yeah.
won't let me use the Going Linux Studio computer.
Okay, there
Okay,
you
yeah. Anyway, hey, Fedora, you should try it next time you have a chance, Larry. You might like it.
go. Okay.
Okay.
I will do just that.
Yeah, well, I'll believe that. You're kind of a Mint fanboy.
I'll try it on another machine. Mint's staying on this one until I find something better.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and get into our voicemails and see what's going on.
Okay, so our first voicemail is from Paul. Let's play that.
Hello, this is Paul from Louisville, Kentucky. I've recently heard that you, Larry, have installed Linux Mint 14 on your computer. And a few months ago, I installed it, and I like it. I like the Cinnamon desktop, but I believe that something is happening with the Cinnamon desktop that I can't seem to put in words on message boards or Google. And I thought maybe you could give me some help on this. If I'm in my browser or just on the desktop itself, all of a sudden the resolution, the screen will become very tiny. And if I double-click on anywhere in that space, it resumes it back to its original size. And I've never had that happen before with other desktops. When Linux Mint 14 using, let's say, the GNOME desktop, that doesn't happen. So I was just wondering if you've ever heard of that. Thanks a lot. I love your podcast. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Well, Paul, I think this is actually something maybe, Bill, that you and I were talking about before we began the recording. I think it's the hot corners that's messing them up here.
Yeah.
Cinnamon Desktop comes with a hot corner predefined, and what that really means is if you put your mouse in one of the corners, and if I remember correctly, on Mint it defaults to the upper left corner, or maybe it's the upper right. No, it's the upper left corner. And I think you said on Fedora it was the upper right corner it defaults to, right?
No, it's the upper left
It's the
corner.
upper left.
Yeah.
Okay. I had to move mine because I was bumping into it all the time. So I actually moved it to the upper right corner on my Mint Cinnamon desktop. But from your description, this is what's happening. You're actually going, your mouse is touching the hot corner, and then you get the overview. And everything, of course, is going to get smaller as a result of that. And then when you click on it or double click on it, it'll come back to normal size. And if you're using a single desktop, then of course, it just looks like your screen went small. And
Yeah.
if you're using multiple desktops, it'll show two, three, four desktops, however many you have, whether there's anything on them or not. And then you click on your one you want to go to after touching the hot corner. So you can disable the hot corners.
Which I do, which I do.
Yeah,
Yeah. I don't
So
like
if
those high corners.
you go into the Cinnamon settings and go into the setting that's called Hot Corners, you can go in there and you can move it, and you can move it to top left, top right, bottom left, bottom right, and you can actually just disable it by unchecking the box that says Hot Corner enabled, and then that'll get rid of that for you. So you can have it do other functions as well if you wish, but it sounds like it's kind of getting in your way. So just go in there into the Cinnamon settings, and just disable it.
Yeah, just as a side note, that's one of the things I do like about Cinnamon is being able to turn off what you don't like. I know it's pretty much straightforward with Cinnamon, but it's not so quite straightforward with like GNOME 3 or whatever. So if that's really getting in its way, just go into the settings. And I believe, isn't the setting, if you're looking at the bottom, bar, there's a, for Cinnamon, there's like something that says settings. It looks like a little up arrow.
Yeah, it's sitting right there on the Cinnamon panel. right normally to the left of the clock if you've got the bottom panel set up as it is in Mint.
Yeah.
If you hover over it, it'll say settings, and then you click on it, and you can go to whatever settings you want to. And the hot corners doesn't come up by default, at least not on on Mint, but there is a selection there for all settings. You go there, and it takes you right to where you need to be to shut off the hot corners or to modify the settings there.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about when he said it kept getting smaller. I said he's probably just hitting a hot corner, like you said. But I just, like I said, you changed yours to a different position, and I just disabled mine. So whatever is easier for him, that's probably be the best. And like I said, it's really easy to do from the settings menu.
Yeah, exactly. And if you've got it in the upper right corner, for example, and you have just one monitor, and you have your close button in the upper right corner of the windows, you're going to bump into that hot corner all the time, because as you go up to close a window to the upper right, you're going to bump into it, and it'll give you that overview and just get in your way. So I actually prefer my close buttons on the left, Ubuntu style. So I've moved them over there. That's something else you can do in Cinnamon, is move the buttons to the left. They provide a nice Cinnamon setting for that. And I moved the hot corner to the right, and that seems to work for me.
Okay. Well, our next email come from Ben, and he writes, "Hello all." Hey, Ben.
Hello, Ben.
"Thanks for everything you guys do on the Going Linux podcast. I recently have loaded Mint with KDE Desktop and was curious of the different editions, Mate, XFCE, KDE, and Cinnamon, and what preference do you have? I have heard Cinnamon thrown around on your podcast a bit, however, was curious if there is a way to change to a different edition without reloading from the image. Thanks, Ben." Thanks for writing, Ben. I'm using Fedora right now, and I like the Cinnamon Desktop. I'm not a fan of the KDE. I've used XFCE, it's okay. And Mate just kind of reminds me of the old GNOME 2. So, kind of looking at the what's available now, I think Cinnamon's a good blend of usability and modern interface, I guess it's the easiest way to say it. What do you think, Larry?
Yeah, I like Cinnamon a lot as well. And for somebody who wants something very, very simple, I will install either XFCE or Mate. If somebody wants, you know, they're familiar with Linux and want ultimate tweakability, I'll recommend KDE. But how you actually make the change, to answer your question, Ben, you can install multiple desktops, and we've covered that in previous episodes as well. But essentially, if you go into the Software Center and you type in the word desktop, among other things that you'll see there, you'll see that the Mate desktop is there. I'm looking at it under Linux Mint, of course. There's a KDE standard that comes up. You can install any of the desktops from the Software Center or from Synaptic Package Manager, if you prefer to go there. In Mint, there's even the Ubuntu desktop as something that you can install. And once you've installed the desktop, the next time you restart, instead of just putting in your username and password, and if you've got it set so that it doesn't prompt you for that, so that it logs you in automatically, you'll have to actually switch it so it prompts you for your username and password. And then as you're putting in your username and password, before you press enter the last time to actually log you in, if you click on the icon for settings, it will let you select which desktop you want to start in. And assuming that you've got multiple desktops installed, you can choose which one you want to launch for this particular session. And you can even determine which one you want to use as your default, so that if you don't select one, it'll go to the default one every single time. So just a way to try them all out. And then, of course, you can uninstall what you don't want later on.
Yeah, and for a little bit more information for him. When you install, if you decide that you want to install like GNOME 3 and Cinnamon, Cinnamon doesn't install a lot of extra stuff. It's like if you had like Mate and then you installed KDE, depending on what version you're running, KDE installs a lot of stuff. But you don't really get that too much with the Cinnamon or the GNOME 3 or XFCE, actually. It just seems like KDE's the only one that kind of adds a bunch of stuff.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Right. Yeah. KDE does a lot because it has, it's going to install all of the applications that come with the KDE version of whatever distribution you're on by default, unless you choose a more basic package to install. It'll install all of the applications that come with KDE, like Dolphin.
Kate.
File manager, yeah,
Kate
text
Wright.
Editor, Amarok, yeah,
they like K's.
No, K this, K that, yeah.
But they, I think he said he has the KDE desktop, so
he's already got that.
Yeah,
that's
he's already
right.
there. So loading the other ones, the Mate, XFCE, and Cinnamon and GNOME 3 probably won't add a whole lot, you know, so he won't have a lot of duplicates. So.
Yeah, you'll probably have...
you're going to have a few. You're going to have, like, different system monitors and stuff, but...
Right, different system monitors. Your file manager will come in. Of course, you can use any file manager in any desktop, pretty much. So, although right now you have Dolphin because you have KDE, when you install, let's say, Cinnamon, you'll end up with the Nemo file manager, and you can run Nemo from within KDE, and you can run... Dolphin from within Cinnamon, even though they come with the other desktop. So that shouldn't be a problem. You can continue to use whichever one you like. And if you are running out of disk space because you've got all this extra stuff installed, you can install uninstall the stuff you don't want.
All right. So let us know how it goes, Ben.
Yeah. Okay, our next email is from Andrew, and he's wondering about the best upgrades for virtual machines. Andrew writes, "Hi, Larry, Tom, and Chief Executive Minion." Hi, Andrew.
Hey.
Chief Executive Minion is now co-host, Andrew. So catch up. I know we got he sent this email well before that last announcement.
I answer to anything. Just don't call me late for dinner.
There you go. Okay. Yeah. So Andrew wrote the backstory. I've recently been listening to your podcast again on virtual machines, with great interest and wish to start using them myself. Currently, I triple boot Ubuntu 12.10, soon to be 13.04, Fedora 18, and Windows 7. When I decided to go Linux almost 2 years ago, I started distro hopping using live USBs, but decided to have Ubuntu and Fedora installed to give them a proper go. I want to start distro hopping again to give other distros a go. However, installing them just to try them out is a bit too invasive, and using a live USB is limiting when it comes to installing programs and using the installation on an ongoing basis. I want to start installing distros into VMs and even wipe Windows off my system and have it in a VM that can start only when needed. This will also mean I won't have to reboot whenever I need or want to switch operating systems. However, I seem to have hit a brick wall in that my system keeps stalling and slowing whenever I try to run a virtual machine using VirtualBox. I want to upgrade my hardware, but finding a balance between cost and performance is confusing me. The actual question... I originally considered AMD's new PowerDriver FX chips, probably an FX6300 or even an FX8350 with lots of cores and clock speed at a price I can afford. However, performance-wise, they do not rate well. The Intel Ivy Bridge i3 and i5 processors with only 2 or 4 cores outperform the AMD 6 and 8 core chips in almost all benchmark tests, but also cost a lot more. Is it better to have more cores or more performance on fewer cores? I also find that determining whether the processors support VM hardware acceleration, AMD V or VTX, is a challenge as they do not always say. Your views on the best type of processor for running VMs in the low to middle price bracket would be appreciated. My ultimate goal is to have only Ubuntu installed as the host OS and all my, quote, trial distros and Windows running in VMs. This will also make life a lot easier if my new motherboard uses UEFI, as I will only need the host OS to have a signed bootloader for secure boot. Thank you for taking the time to read my email. Keep up the good work. Andrew in Perth, Australia.
Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks. And, you know, for virtual machines, as long as you have a processor that performs well on your hardware, I think you're okay for whichever processor you you decide to run. There may be some other technical issues that crop up, but generally speaking, if you've got a processor that runs well on your hardware, it'll probably run very well in your virtual machine, and it's the RAM that really determines the performance of the virtual machine more than anything else. I think that the more RAM you can dedicate to the virtual machine, the better, which means the more RAM you have in your machine, the better. There is some factor involved related to the performance of the chipset for the processor, but in my experience, the performance of your virtual machine has more to do with RAM than anything else. What about you, Bill?
Yeah, I tend to agree. The more RAM you can throw at the virtual machines, the better. I will say he did say that the pile drivers, and I don't know too much about the chips, but I remember reading a review of when they first come out. They were decent. He said that the performance-wise, it didn't rate well. I think if you're comparing them against, other chips, it's kind of, hard to say how they perform. I mean, you gotta kind of look at the benchmarks and see, you know, how they compare. But it doesn't hurt that if you can only afford, an AMD pile driver chip and it has, you know, 6-8 cores, I would say go ahead and, get the best that you can afford and, use the money that you save to buy more RAM. That will probably give you the best bang for your buck, because the more RAM you can throw at the virtual machine, it seems to run smoother. You can throw a core at it and then, you know, hit it with some RAM and it should run okay. I mean, you're going to have a small performance hit when you're running a virtual machine anyway. But I don't know. Is that how you kind of see it, Larry?
Yeah. If you're really concerned about performance, rather than run the operating system in a virtual machine, I would get a second hard drive. It sounds like this is a desktop computer as opposed to a laptop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just install a second hard drive if you can afford it, and then do my distro hopping on that hard drive if you really need the performance. If performance isn't really your primary consideration for the operating systems you're going to run in the virtual machine, then the virtual machine is probably just fine, and whatever you choose for your processor is probably just fine as well.
Yeah.
And just dedicate some RAM to it. I'd spend the money on additional RAM before I'd upgrade the processor, quite frankly.
Yeah.
And as far as which one is better, it depends on what year you're sitting in and what year you're listening to this, but here early in 2013, I think general consensus is that the Intels have better performance than the AMDs, but that could change with the next iteration of those two manufacturers of chipsets. But I haven't built a computer from scratch. I haven't used a desktop computer as my main computer for probably 6 or 8 years. So I'm not the best one to be talking about hardware on a desktop computer and which is the best, because I'm not working with it every day.
Yeah. I would, like I said, get the best chip that you can afford comfortably and then use the money that you saved to throw in some extra RAM. And I think that would give you more bang for your buck.
Yep. Okay. Yep.
All right. Our next email comes from Gordon on feedback for episode 204. He writes, a couple of comments. I have been interested in voice recognition for many years since the first voice input boards become available for CPM systems in the late 70s. I hope Sphinx will produce something useful someday, but there's nothing in Sphinx today for an end user. They describe the project as a collection of open source tools and resources that allows researchers and developers to build speech recognition systems. Stop with the tools already. Put a wrapper around it so I can dictate into a text file, please. I can't help thinking that if the tools actually worked, someone would actually have fulfilled my request a long time ago. Also, the version in Ubuntu repositories is not even close to being current, 0.5 versus 0.8. Second point about partitions. Many newer hard drives use GPT, but many existing systems and some newer ones use MBR partitioning. With MBR, you can only have 4 primary partitions, and a lot of systems ship with all 4 allocated, including my HP G62 laptop. You can shrink the main partition all you want, but the only way to use the space is to blow away one of the existing partitions, then create a partition, hopefully an extended partition, which uses the free space. If the computer comes with a program which lets you make a recovery DVD or CD set, you can do that, then delete the recovery partition. If you're lucky, it's right next to the space you made by shrinking the main partition, so the new partition can include the space from both. On my G62, HP Tools was in between, so I copied the contents and blew it away too. Then I made an extended partition. Within an extended partition, you can make all the partitions you want. I made a little one called HP Tools, another one called Recovery with nothing in it, a root, a swap, and a home. Later I came back and made another so I can have 3 operating systems installed. Love the podcast. Gord Campbell.
Okay, thanks. Well, thanks, Gord. Yeah, we've had a bit of a discussion in the forums over at forums.goinglinux.com, and the whole idea that there are only 4 partitions available is not necessarily true. I think what is going on is that the computer manufacturers are putting partitions in. I don't know whether they're doing this intentionally or not, but they're putting the partitions in place in a way that doesn't allow you to expand additional partitions. I know somebody was talking about Windows 8 installing 8 partitions, or 4 partitions rather, that's all you could install unless you blew it away and started over again. And I think, again, that has more to do with the way the computer manufacturer has chosen to put those partitions on the desktop. Inet Can in the forums has experimented around with Windows 8 on partitions, and he said that it installs by default from a Windows install CD very much like any other Windows or any other operating system, and it doesn't by default use up all the disk space with and lock out any additional partitions. I think it's just the way these computer manufacturers have chosen to install the software. So I don't think there's any problem in dual booting or triple booting or quadruple booting or whatever you want. You may have to monkey around with the partitions if they came from your computer manufacturer that way. But one way to solve that whole problem is to build your own computer from scratch. And if you don't want to do that, you can always buy one with Linux preloaded on it, and then you can do what you want.
Yeah, so you don't have to work so hard just to get Linux on a machine.
Yep.
I will say Gord's right about one thing. Before you do anything, make sure you make those restore CDs from that recovery partition.
Yep.
Very important. I had some friends have some problems with that. They didn't make the recovery disks, and now their drive is toast, and they now having to pay to get a restore disk, and it's a big mess. So yeah, make those disks if you're going to be running any of the Windows, because they don't ship disks anymore. I don't know why they do that.
Cost.
You think it's that little bit of money they save on that little disk is really going to, you know, amount to anything?
I do. The cost of computers and computer parts and so on is very high compared to the profit they're making on it,
mm-hmm.
which is one of the reasons why they put so much crapware on it, because they can get some revenue from the crapware, quite frankly. But yeah, they look for cost cutting wherever they can in these machines. It's not like a Mac where everything is marked up to the point where they can afford to give you the best quality and do put a lot of effort into ensuring fit and finish. With PC makers, they're looking to cut corners wherever they can to reduce cost, including not sending out a CD if they don't have to.
Well, just out of curiosity, do you know what they pay for a license? They have to pay for a license for every machine, right?
Yeah, and I think they get a break if they don't provide they get a break on the cost of the operating system if they don't provide a CD, install CD. And if they do, then they have to pay more for their copy of Windows, if it's Windows they're putting on there. So I know it's a fraction of the cost you would pay retail. So if you're paying $200, $300, $400 for Windows 8 in a store, if you just walk in and say, give me a full copy, not an upgrade, you're going to pay like $400. But the OEM version that goes on a Dell, for example, it probably costs them $20.
Wow.
Because of they're installing so many on so many computers, hundreds of thousands of computers, just volume license, they can get a really good deal on the price.
So that's why they say that license is tied to that hardware, so you can't move it off.
That's licensing. That's licensing, and that's from Microsoft. That is not with Dell or HP or any of the computer manufacturers. The operating system licensing is going to determine that. And, you know, Dell may have their own policy on how they've installed it and what their image, their backup and restore image is. But the licensing for Windows is the licensing for Windows, and that's controlled by Microsoft.
Yeah. So the moral story is make those DVDs or CDs, and if you don't have to do that, just run Linux.
Yeah. The computer you were talking about, this is the one you were telling me about earlier, where they just bought a brand new Windows 8 computer, got it infected right away, and hadn't made this restore. So now they're forced to pay more.
Yeah. Well, just a brief story. They're neighbors, so they called and asked if I'd come over and look at their machine. They had just bought this for their daughters. So I went and looked at it, and it was infected with pop-ups of some pretty obnoxious stuff. And I said, well, where's your, CDs, or restore CDs? Well, we didn't get any. I said, you didn't make them? No, we didn't make them. So you actually have to supply blank DVDs to make it. So no one ever seems to make these. So I said, okay, well, let's see if we can install. I have a Windows 8 DVD. Let me see if I can use your key. I said, I don't think it'll work, but we can give it a whirl. And it didn't work. It says it's an invalid key. So I said, well, let's call Dell. Well, the first person they talked to said they need to call Microsoft. So then they called Microsoft, and Microsoft told them that they don't handle OEM licenses, that they need to talk to the people they got their computer from. So they had to call Dell. And apparently they got the second person they talked to, knew what they were doing, and said, you're going to have to pay us, I think it was $30 or something, to get this restore DVD, restore media. And so then they have to wait for it to arrive. So right now they're running a live DVD of Mint, so their kids can write their reports on LibreOffice, and I let them borrow a USB drive so they can store their reports and print on the USB drive and carry it to school to print it out. So kind of a roundabout way of getting it to work, but it works.
Yeah. Well, and as I suggested to you, I'd be tempted to have them buy a new hard drive, install Linux on there, replace the Windows 8 hard drive with the Linux hard drive, and then send the hard drive back to Dell and say, hey, there's something wrong with this. It's infected.
Well, you know, they were commenting on how well Mint worked, and their kids were using it with no problems. I mean, basically, they sat down, they didn't even need to tell them how to use it, or, you know, they had problems with Windows 8, they couldn't figure out how to get the thing to work. Mm-hmm. But he said something that just kind of blew me away. He said, this Linux Mint works great, and it does everything we need, but I think I might send it back and get a Mac.
Okay.
I'm like, okay. Anyway, we'll see how that plays out. But I was just amazed. I said, hey, this works. This Linux works great. Everything works. We get the proper resolution on our monitor, we can surf the web on this live CD. But I think we're gonna send it back and get a Mac.
Mm-hmm.
Because Macs never get any viruses, apparently.
Okay. Yeah. And what's wrong with what you're using right now?
I didn't say it. I just was like, okay.
Bite your tongue, Bill. Bite your tongue.
Anyway, so they're still, just so to finish this, they are still using Mint, and their kids are surfing the web and doing their reports, and I guess they need a Mac. Okay, moving right along,
yes. So our next email is from Jeff. Jeff writes, hi there, Larry, Tom, Bill.
Hi,
Jeff. And he writes Larry, Tom, Bill, all as though it were one word. Just been listening to episode 203, and I don't think you mentioned a particular topic, which I find irritating. That is the apparent inability to enable users to identify new file extensions to be displayed as existing icons. Probably not explaining that too well. I would like my Mint 13 Cinnamon install to use the icon for video files for .nuv files. And my understanding of a .nuv file is that that's a file extension that represents a MIF box video file. I could be wrong there. But I cannot seem to be able to find a way, and the forums suggest it isn't possible. Any light you can shed on this would be greatly appreciated. Fantastic show. I seem to have been listening to it forever. You guys are great. Please keep them coming. Jeff from across the pond. Well, Jeff, it's been a long time since I wanted to assign a particular icon to a type of file. Bill, have you done this recently?
I don't know if this really counts. I just did it last night. I think this is what he's talking about. I went to, and all my sound files, I always go to properties and tell it to always open with VLC.
Right.
So,
and it'll give that little construction cone icon.
Yeah, on every one of the files that it can open. So there's, because I don't like the some of the built-in movie players. I always like VLC. So I always tell it to assign that file type to VLC. And it always gives the cone. I guess that's, whatever icon it is it's associated to. So is that what he's talking about?
Yeah, that's kind of what he's talking about. So you can do what you just suggested, Bill, which is to change which application opens it by default, and the icon that it will use will be related to the one for that application. But what he's really talking about is he wants, independently of the application, to say, okay, I want these NUV files to always use this Linux icon. So if he wanted to use the smiley face icon, he would want to use that independently of which application is running it. Now, I know many moons ago when I was running KDE 3, this was quite easy to do. I haven't done it since running KDE 3. So I know it's possible under Linux. With Cinnamon, a lot of that stuff is hidden. behind the scenes, primarily for supporting ease of use as opposed to tweakability. And so I know it's possible. You may have to get into the command line to do it. I don't recall what it is, but you might want to check around in maybe some other forums for maybe Gentoo or Slackware or other forums where this is a little more common practice. Linux Mint is typically going to be for people who don't even think about doing that kind of thing. And so you might want to think about that.
Yeah, couldn't he go to the – he didn't say which forums he went to, but
– I was assuming it was Mint because he's running Mint.
Go to the Mythbuntu forums.
Oh, yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
And sure.
Since that's a Mythbuntu extension, surely those guys will know how to do it if it can be done.
Yeah, and, you know, Myth TV, he probably installed that on his Mint 13 Cinnamon. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that's a good suggestion, Bill. I think that's good.
Okay. Mike sent us an email on UEFI Secure Boot. He goes, hi.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Mike.
I really like your show. I will be getting a brand new HP desktop computer, and he gives us the model. It's P6-2220T 64-bit with Windows 7. How can I tell if it has Microsoft UEFI Secure Boot? I emailed HP, but they are not sure. Planning to load Linux Mint, so I don't want to mess things up. Take care, Mike. I went and looked. I used Google, of course, to see if I could find some information for Mike. And I put the links that I found in the show notes, but I don't think it has Secure Boot, because I was looking at the specs, and it says it can run Windows XP, and so I'm thinking that it doesn't. I looked up the chipset, and nothing in it says anything about Secure Boot, so I would have to say it doesn't have it.
Yeah, and I wouldn't expect HP Tech Support to know whether it has Secure Boot or not. This is early days for Secure Boot, and you know, until they've had this question a bazillion times, they probably won't know. But yeah, a computer that comes pre-installed with Windows 7 and is compatible with Windows XP probably doesn't have it. But and I know you're purchasing a new computer. If you can get the store that you're thinking of buying it from, or maybe you're planning on buying it online, but if you can find it in a store, if you can get them to allow you to try to boot from a live CD or a thumb drive, you might be able to tell, or even just boot into the BIOS and see if there's anything in there that talks about Secure Boot or UEFI and whether or not there's a setting to shut it off. That would be the best way. But I think you're right, Bill. I think this computer is sufficiently new that it'll give Mike all the specs that he needs, but sufficiently old that it doesn't include Secure Boot. It may have UEFI, but the critical thing is Secure Boot, which is the Microsoft thing that they've required their manufacturers to adhere to if they want Windows 8 certification. And since this isn't a computer that was built for Windows 8, I suspect it's not there.
I want to make a note. When I was looking up the specs for this motherboard, trying to find out if it had Secure Boot, I noticed that it only can be upgraded to 8 gigabytes of memory. And mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of low for a new computer. I mean, I thought most of them are now at least 16. So just wanted to bring that to his attention, because, you know, I tend to, keep mine for a while, so I like to be able to upgrade. So if it comes with, you know, 4, he'll only be able to double the memory. So more bang for your buck. So you just might want to see if, you know, think about long term if he'll need more than 8 gigabytes in the future. Just, you know, something to keep in mind.
Just a thought. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Our next email is from Jay with ramblings from show 204. At least that's what he says. Hi, Larry, Tom, and Bill. Hi, Jay.
Hey, Jay.
I just listened to show 204 tonight and thought I would weigh in on a couple of topics you raised. First, Larry and Bill were discussing the Cinnamon Desktop on SUSE Linux. I just read an article on the web that the latest version of GNOME 3, 3.8, now has a built-in classic mode. This brings back the old taskbar look for those not happy with GNOME 3's shiny new default. Here's a link from PC World about the announcement. Please ignore the fact that it was released on April Fool's Day. We'll include that link in the show notes, of course. Second, KY in the chat mentioned problems with his virtual machine web server being seen from the internet. You mentioned several articles by Nightwise on the subject, which are great references, but the solution is actually very simple. Virtual machine software programs such as VirtualBox set up their virtual machines to run under NAT networking, N-A-T networking by default. This means that any virtual machines are hidden behind a virtual router on the host PC. Nothing else on your LAN will be able to access these machines by default. What KY should do is go to the virtual machine setting and change this. On VirtualBox, this is under the device menu, and then go to Network tab. Simply change the NAT setting to Bridged Adapter, and your virtual machine will now be visible on the host network. Port forwarding from his UVerse router should now see it. That's exactly what I was struggling to express, and I haven't done it, so I knew the setting was there. I just didn't know what it was. Keep in mind, you're now live on the web, so keep those firewall settings up in your virtual machine. So thanks very much for that, Jay, and I think that will help out the listener who was trying to figure this out. That's great. Lastly, I heard your first listener virtually slap Bill's hand for bad-mouthing Fedora. I'm actually the person who wrote the email on SSD drives to which Bill voiced his original amazement of using Fedora in a production environment. I just wanted to say that I have heard similar complaints from expert users about Fedora's new install process. Honestly, it went very easily for me. My only complaint was the installer team put the OK button in the upper left corner of each window, exactly the opposite of where every other computer has placed it for the past 20 years. However, it was manageable. To date, my only issue in my daily use of the machine that worked previously on older versions is the VNC server capability. On my Windows XP virtual machine, I often run teleconferences using GoToMeeting, which has no native Linux client. My company develops software that runs on Linux, and in the past, I have usually just set up a VNC to the host machine using the bridged adapter setting on my VM, as mentioned above, so that I could display a Linux window in my Windows XP environment that could be seen on GoToMeeting. Unfortunately, the server has issues in Fedora 18. Google searches show it's not just me. I've worked around it by a VPN connection to my office to display the demo. Otherwise, it's really been rock solid for day-to-day use. In summary, yes, Fedora gets a lot of patches, but that's one of the reasons I wanted to upgrade, since I was concerned about security on older releases. So, Bill, nothing to fear here. Come, join the Fedora dark side. We have really yummy cookies. As always, cookies. Thanks for a great show, Jay. P.S. The SSD drive continues to scream along. Love it, love it, love it.
Okay, first off, Jay, you're the one of the reasons I went with Fedora. So I take the cookies and I eat them, and they're yummy.
Okay, it looks like we've run out of emails here, Bill. Yeah, so I guess we'll just wrap up the show.
Well, before we wrap up the show, I have a software pick.
Okay.
We hadn't done one in a while, and I found a new audio player called Clementine. It reminds me a lot of iTunes and its abilities, and it has a ability to stream music, download podcasts. It's kind of like everything's built in to this nice clean interface. So it's in the repositories. So if you're looking for something a little different from Rhythmbox or Banshee, look at Clementine. I think you might like it.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard of Clementine, so it's not a brand new, just hot off the presses audio player, but it's something that is obviously new to you. It's new to me. I haven't used it. I've heard of it. But my audio player is actually built into my Android phone, so I don't actually listen to audio on my computer other than in Audacity to edit it.
Well, you do listen to us yammering for hours on end, so you know we go.
I do. Yeah. So that's enough.
Yeah. But okay.
And I don't have a software pick, but I do have a tip. And that comes out of our setup for our previous recording, not this one, but the one we did last time. I found that I had two versions of Skype installed. And I found that that's what was causing my crashes of Skype on Computer America episodes. Why it was not happening here on our shows, I don't know. But somehow I ended up with two different versions, actually two the same versions of Skype installed. One downloaded from the Skype website and the other from the Mint Cinnamon repositories. They were the same version. They didn't appear to be running simultaneously, but something was happening that was causing some interference between the two. When I found out, when I went to uninstall Skype and replace it, when I found out that I had two versions installed, I uninstalled both. I had to uninstall each one independently, of course, and then installed the latest version of Skype from the website, and that fixed all the problems. So check your Skype. I think what happened was I installed it from the website, and then somehow the updater identified that I had Skype, tried to install an update, installed the same version over top of the other one, didn't replace the other version because it was installed maybe in a different location. I don't know that for a fact, but I'm guessing. Somehow it got all messed up. So just be a little careful. If you're having problems with Skype, feel free to blame Microsoft, but check and make sure that you don't have the two versions installed as I did.
I think, Larry, they were the same version, but there was a point release difference.
Yeah, that could be. That makes a little more sense I don't think it would.
Yeah, because I remember when you asked me what version I was running, and I told you, and then you went, you checked yours and say, okay, I'm running an older one. Then you went to the website and found out that that you had gotten the point release. You hadn't reinstalled, you know, they had done something. So when you uninstalled it.
So, yeah, now that you mentioned it, I do recall that. So anyway, it's fixed now.
Yay.
So that's working okay.
Okay.
All right. Anything else before we wrap up?
No, I think I've rat-holed this one more than enough.
So our next episode will be Sabian and Sousa, a review by Bill. Until then, you can go to the articles and show notes at goinglinux.com for more information, detailed instructions, screencasts, and illustrations.
And remember, if you have a topic you want us to cover on the show, use the forums to leave your topic suggestion in the thread labeled Topic Suggestions. Our forums are at forum.goinglinux.com.
If you want to support our efforts, click the donate button while you're there. You can also send us an audio comment by email. We'll play it on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com, and our voicemail, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail message, is 1-904-468-7889.
Follow our show updates on Twitter, tweet us at goinglinux, or join our Google Plus community. Look for Going Linux Podcast. You can download the episodes from our website, or you can play them right from the show notes page.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
73.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.